Set your mind to it. Morgan saw the trivial imposition in front of him as but a frontline pawn in a chess game that had to be sacrificed. He needed Jack to see it that way. It was no more than that. The game was in motion. The goal was to win. The king had to be protected. Knights, bishops only played as long as they served, as long as they were necessary. This was the first lesson of the game. And Titanic was being maneuvered into position by this strategist. Jack was to pick up on it now or be sacrificed. "I've just received word, Astor, Guggenheim, and Strauss have made reservations on the Titanic," said Jack. "Are you sure?" Morgan asked. "Yes, they are getting on at Cherbourg," said Jack. This put a strange look in Morgan's eyes. This is something he hadn't planned on. Was it luck? Fate? Chance? What should he do? His mind raced. What were the chances that Astor would be stranded in Europe and having to take a Morgan ship home? He had known that Astor had come over on the Olympic to get away from the bad press that, in part, Morgan's paper had given him. Morgan wanted to belittle him and ridicule his name in the papers. He wanted to sway public opinion away from Astor. Not that Astor was running for office, but he had massive influence. Bad press was effective. Morgan's papers wrote up articles about his new bride, the 19-year-old beauty, Madeline. Morgan's paper made it to be a scandal, and ridiculed Astor for divorcing his wife to take this teenager. It was the age of stable marriage. Astor was a new breed. He married as he loved. Morgan disliked all three men, Astor, Guggenheim, and Strauss. Their way of making money was as different as night and day from his. These three together had enough influence to change the entire direction of an issue, banking for one. Morgan had already watched his ideal banking bill be pushed out of the Senate a year earlier, because of their influence. It didn't even come up for a vote. He was determined that it would pass in the next vote. Astor was a businessman who made money from retail and goods. It was thought he was the richest man in America. Morgan made his money from banking. How he spent it was another matter. Had Astor not known the White Star Line was owned by International Mercantile Marine, Morgan's company? Did he care? At the mention of Astor, Guggenheim and Strauss traveling on the Titanic, Morgan's expression hastily changed. "Yes, I've seen the list. Astor is on it. I guess they haven't heard of the near miss in Southampton." Jack was now the sweet prince Morgan had born from his own loins. "Astor on Titanic. You have accomplished more than I had even dreamed." Morgan's interest was keen. He gleaned something in his son now that swirled there deep in his blood. "We've enticed everyone and there is no other ship leaving," Jack replied. "Considering the coal strike's disruption, all the shipping schedules and crossings were cancelled. So anyone leaving will have to take Titanic." "Jack. This is the very thing that has impressed me." Morgan wanted to retire knowing all was safe in Jack's keeping. So enamored was he with his son. "It is quite a list of the well-to-do." "It is amazing," Jack let his father know to gain this admiration and acceptance like mine's. "This is splendid," thrilled Morgan. "Yes, and everything they read about Titanic, they believe. I added in that it's the ship of dreams," said Jack, proud of his work. "True genius, Jack," but Morgan was now deep in thought. "The look of her is still a number one class ship, the most beautiful ship to sail the sea." "It is really turning into an extravaganza," Jack continued, wanting acclaim. But it was lost for the moment. "This changes everything," said Morgan. He picked up the decanter of scotch. Cancel my reservation on Titanic at the last moment. Morgan hesitated, say I'm not well. And a strange look came over Morgan's face. You take the crates of gold off in Cherbourg right then. Remember, they are marked as museum crates. Morgan poured a drink. The white gold liquor flowed from the crystal, swirling and finally resting in the glass. As he watched the legs of fine liquor run down the inside curve of the glass, the plan formed in his mind, as if he saw it in the glistening film of scotch he took to his lips. Put it onto my yacht, bound for New York. Morgan scanned the blueprints of the sister ships, diligently. Titanic has to sink, and I don't trust any of them. Not Smith, not Andrews, not Ismay, not Lord Peary. We shall see she sinks. Sinks. The deed was already done in his mind and at the point of no return. Get Captain Lord in here, he said to Jack. Chapter 63. Morgan's Yacht, Cherbourg, France 1912. Morgan stood with a true magnetic stature as Captain Lord entered. Jack greeted him while Morgan puffed intently on his cigar, the smoke swirling around his head like a halo. It was odd how it hung there, and Captain Lord took note of it as he took off his hat and gloves. Lord had heard the talk of the near-miss Titanic ad. He wondered if Morgan had called him in to perhaps take a liner from Cherbourg on to New York, relieving Smith. He saw the headline on the paper there on the desk, Titanic Near Miss, but made no mention, letting Morgan do the invitation. He kept his chest stiff and straight. He was impressed by the yacht and Morgan's wealth. Lord had worked his way up through the ropes since he was 13, when he got his first training. At the age of 23 he obtained his master's certificate and by 1906 was given his first command. This was an exciting moment for him to be in so splendid a craft. Morgan had called for him. His mind conjured up many ideas of how he should respond and take the commission. Yes, Mr. Morgan, I would be grateful. Well, Mr. Morgan, I am qualified and the right man for the job. Thank you, Mr. Morgan, it is an honor. He'd better stop thinking and be ready to answer. Being in Morgan's presence was highly intoxicating. It all reeked of wealth and Captain Lord wanted to be part of it. Morgan offered him a cigar. Jack offered him an 18-year-old scotch. As the liquor hit his throat, the heat of it warmed the chill of the early spring air. It all mingled with the thoughts. He deemed, Smith's out, I'm in. This is fantastic to be here in the presence of the Morgans and to be offered the prestigious position as captain of the most glorious ship in the world. And I shall steer her clear. No foul shall become her under my command. He looked tall to take notice of his shoes looking thick with polish to cover the wear. He puffed his cigar as Jack courteously lit it for him. It was all too exciting. This was a moment he had not expected. The feel of such a ship under his feet gave him stature. It was sure that the size of Morgan's yacht had impressed him, but it was the whole legacy, and now here he was, in front of the man himself, enjoying a cigar and with the finest aged scotch quenching his palate. He was seduced more easily than most. So you will be on the California, Morgan stated. You're comfortable with her, I assume. You take her up here, he pointed on the map. There is a nice field this time of year. Are you familiar with it? Yes, Lord said as he wrote down the position in his little ledger. His letdown was hard. He was so sure that he was going to be asked to take up Smith's position. Smith almost lost the ship in port, he screamed in his head. He wanted to say his piece and offer his service to Titanic. That would be out of line. How could you let Smith take her now after what he just did? Morgan, Did you not read the paper? He almost crashed your ship. For God's sake, give me the command. He yelled in his thoughts and down the scotch to quiet his head. So you see then, the voyage will be no strain, Morgan continued. You have little cargo but woolen sweaters, blankets and brandy. You'll be there the 14th. You wait for the colored distress rockets. Now make sure of it, colored only, Morgan's voice was low. Jack almost wanted to correct Morgan for he thought he gave Lord the wrong color. He remembered he had given Smith the order of white rockets, but then it came to Jack that Morgan's devious plan was at hand, so he said nothing. Yes, sir, Lord responded. You want me to wait for the colored distress rockets? He confirmed. It seemed simple. We have a very powerful Morse lamp. I suppose it can be seen for about 10 miles, Captain Lord added, and I will have the radio operator listen for any distress signals. We are able. Morgan cut in, no, no. Just watch for the colored rockets, Morgan was adamant. You will pick up all the passengers. Captain Lord could tell he hit a nerve and switched his rudder. How full is the passenger list? Jack looked at the figures. We've 2,224 passengers more or less and crew on her book. What's your number of lifeboats? Asked Lord. We know there aren't enough. We didn't want to crowd the deck space for the first class viewing and all, well, they take up so much room. I know that looks to be of a concern, but you'll handle that, said Jack. I'm not an inspector. Is there a number? Captain Lord asked. Good then. Titanic carries enough lifeboats for 1,178 people, slightly more than half of the number on board, said Jack. Around 885 crew, 324 in first class, 284 in second class and 709 in third class. There are 107 children booked so far. The largest number of passengers is in third class. These are good number to work with. I can do it. Thank you, Lord wanted to know what he was up against. Morgan was done. He never liked long meetings. Thank you. That is all? Jack handed Lord a payment envelope. Lord tipped his hat and left. What is going on? You tell Captain Lord to wait for colored rockets and you tell Captain Smith to send white? Jack stood questioning before the old man. We do what we have to. It's business. Morgan patted his son on the back and went for a scotch. Am I going to have to be involved in this continual sort of despicable behavior? Jack thought. And so now it is written, said Morgan. Chapter 64. RMS Titanic, Cherbourg 1912. Captain Smith stood at the top of the bridge as Titanic made her way into the French port, the tugs pulling her in. All Cherbourg was at the dock to see the great ship. Smith was a sight to see, making his appearance on the deck. He posed for a photo. He was quite the image of White Star Line as he stood there at the helm. He puffed out his chest and pulled in his stomach. Few had heard of the mishap. The passengers were led on by class. The third was boarded, then the second, and then the first class. This allowed the first class to arrive much later and have less time waiting around for the actual departure. They didn't have to wade through the crowded lines and luggage. Smith would personally greet the first class passengers upon their boarding. Finally, all were on and the ship was set. Up in the wireless room, Jack Phillips, senior Marconi wireless operator, was busy. There was a constant flow of sending and receiving messages and telegrams, mostly inconsequential matters relating to senior officers and first-class passengers. Then, suddenly, one really important incoming message made him sit up straight and take notice. From J.P. Morgan, Aix-les-Bains, France. To Bruce Ismay, Titanic, England. Unwell, stop. Cancel my travel on Titanic. Stop. Morgan, stop. Phillips, recognizing the importance of the message, immediately left the wireless cabin and walked the few yards down the deck to the bridge, where Captain Smith was busy fussing over some minor issue or other. He was deep in conversation with Chief Officer Henry Wilde and Ismay, checking the passenger list. "Pardon me for the interruption, sir," he said respectfully. "I thought I should bring this to your attention immediately." Smith took the message from Philip's hand and quickly read it. He showed Ismay. "Yes, thank you, Bride," said Smith, confusing him with his more junior colleague, Harold Bride. "It's Phillips, sir," Phillips said. But Smith didn't hear. Smith's mind was elsewhere when he saw the message and his mind raced. He was angry. Was he left to pull this off alone? A telegram. That's how it comes to me? What an ass Morgan is, he thought. Ill, for God's sake. What rubbish? The man is never ill. He's not ill. He never planned to go in the first place, that bastard. He never intended to see it through. Do I still go through with it? Should I just say I'm ill too? I'm the one who has to go through with it. I could bow out here and take my due. But then I'd have the gravestone to mark my record, sure. Young Phillips thought it strange the expression Smith's face held. But Ismay understood. He too felt lied to and suspicious. Of all the times to get sick, Ismay didn't believe it either. Morgan was just making sure he isn't around when all this comes down. There is no reply for the moment. You may return to your duties now, Smith looked concerned. He could not hide his anxiety from Wilde. Is there a problem, sir? Wilde asked, a little worried himself. No, no, Mr. Wilde, he replied. Smith felt distinctly uneasy. I'm sure it's nothing to worry about, but Mr. Morgan is ill and apparently we won't be having the pleasure of his company on this trip after all, said Smith. Nevertheless, he called for a William Murdoch, the first officer, and instructed him to make the necessary arrangements for the unloading of all Morgan's crates. Smith and Ismay went into the captain's quarters. He closed the door and turned angry. I was told Morgan would be on board, Smith growled. What's it matter if he's on or not? Ismay blocked. Don't give me that. Did you know about this? Smith fired. I'm just as glad to be rid of him, stated Ismay. Is this thing on? Do we call it off? Smith wanted to know. He was having second thoughts. We stick to the plan, get a hold of yourself, said Ismay, not really sure himself. You knew all along, Smith accused him. No. I just found out this instant. But it doesn't change anything, Ismay defended. It changes everything, said Smith. I could say there's a starboard list, I'd have every right to turn her around. Take it up with Morgan when you get back, said Ismay as he went for the door. Smith grabbed him. I'm responsible for all these people, said Smith, holding up the passenger list. There are children on board. We are moving ahead as scheduled, Ismay insisted. Smith said hard, look here, why don't you find yourself another captain? What? Now? We're about to set off, Ismay said, and besides, Morgan will never let you off the hook. He has us all by the balls. Chapter 65. Nemo, 1993. The lights of Nemo glowed as they descended deeper into the sea on the dive. Jade was disenchanted. She couldn't hold it in any longer. Why would Morgan let Smith on his new liner after he crashed Olympic? That doesn't make sense. Where did you hear that? Asked Johns. Is that radio off? Asked Masters. He checked to see it was. What? You're going to bring this up now? That angered Masters. Her inquiring mind was wearing on him. He had been thinking seriously about how desperately she had thrown questions at him at every given opportunity for the past few days, questions he had not addressed, questions he threw out of his thoughts, questions he regarded as dangerous, that he had wanted to avoid. He had wanted the documentary to take one's focus away from those kinds of questions. He felt threatened by this filmmaker. You want me to lose the whole operation? My funding. I can't let that happen. For the strip, this time, just film a documentary. What if you take off those rusticles and you see Olympic engraved underneath? Jade threw back. You'll never make that film. Masters meant it, staring her dead in the eye. What are you saying? Asked Johns. Do you hear what she's saying? If I take you to the bowl, and what you say is true, then what? I lose everything, my books, my credibility, the funding. This is all so you can sell books? She flailed. This isn't in your books, said Johns. What are you talking about? Olympic? What the hell? You think that's Olympic down here? You shut up, Masters said to Johns. Then he turned on Jade. You want a few facts? There's plenty of evidence of a party and drunken officers while they were heading into an ice field. Evidence the crew never had a lifeboat drill. That's evident in the record, so what? What will it change? Masters seethed. This is incredible. If this is Olympic, what the fuck? Johns swallowed. Johns had never seen Masters hook on a line in such deep waters, fighting to get free. But the harder he pulled from this woman, the deeper the hook went in. So you're proposing there is no gold? Morgan pulled a switch. He fooled everybody, Johns said. So you're saying he got the gold and sank Olympic, his own ship, to cover it up? It was about the insurance, she said. 1,500 people. They died. You come off like a hero. How you'll protect Titanic? It's all fake, Jade was disenchanted. There's evidence Captain Smith slept fully dressed. He'd never do that under normal conditions. And Captain Lord slept fully dressed. But it ends there, Jade. You can't get anywhere with it. That's what I'm saying. He thumbed the map. What the hell does it mean? Jade asked. Your curiosity could cost me my work. It's easy for you to jump in, only, it's at my expense. And there are other people. People who will stop you. What people? She wanted to know. People with power. They're not concerned with your ideals, his sarcastic words came. It all makes sense. What am I supposed to do? She hammered. This is. Let it alone, he cut her off. Johns agreed as he looked at Masters. This is our chance. You stand to make a lot of money, if you keep your mouth shut. You won't change a thing by bringing this up. Now that leaves us with the gold, and at least the purser's safe. Gold was the game, they were gearheads. Masters was one whether he admitted it or not. It was in his blood. Chapter 66 Titanic, 1912. In the gentleman's smoking room, Master was writing telegrams before departure with Guggenheim and Strauss. "Look at this, Strauss," he said, showing him the telegram he had just received. "I just got this word." Titanic hadn't even got away from the dockside and there was already a near collision. She almost collided with the SS New York in Southampton. "You're joking, surely?" said Strauss, more than a little taken aback at this grave news. "They weren't going to tell us either," he added, nonchalantly knocking the ash from his cigar into a convenient ashtray. "I'd like to see that story in Morgan's New York Times," said Guggenheim sarcastically. "Ismay spotted Astor, Guggenheim, and Strauss." He straightened his tie and made his way over. "I'm the owner of the White Star Line, Bruce Ismay. How do you do, Mr. Astor, Mr. Strauss?" "Morgan is the owner," said Astor. "I'm actually managing director. If there's any comfort you need, please do let me know. There will be some good cards, a little gambling for the gentleman in the drawing room this evening," enticed Ismay. "I hear Morgan is on this ship." Astor looked at him and noticed Ismay's eyes glance away. "Unfortunately, no," Ismay replied. Astor sensed Ismay was hiding something. He didn't like the way Ismay was squirming, like he wanted to get away. Astor could sense things like that. He had learned to read people. "You're saying Morgan is not aboard," Astor said. "He canceled at the last." "Some sort of illness," Ismay nodded. "You're aware the ship has almost hit the SS New York." "Why weren't we alerted?" said Astor. He thought it all seemed underdone. "Nothing to worry about. Please excuse me," and with that Ismay sneaked away. "I say he seemed strange, what do you think?" asked Astor. "He did seem rather touchy, a bit stiff," Strauss agreed. Astor penned his message while he spoke, "Arrive New York early 17th. Stop. Astor. Stop. I've sent word on ahead to Congressman Lindbergh that we are determined to block that bill. And he's called for hearings into the money trust. If he can expose that they are behind the bill, this would be big." He looked pensive as he beckoned his personal servant over with instructions to ensure that the message would be top of the pile of those waiting to be sent out by wireless. He stuffed a crisp new $5 bill into his hand, almost a week's wages to him, in order to emphasize the urgency of the matter, and with that the servant shuffled off with the message. He turned to Strauss. "We shall have dinner with Congressman Lindbergh upon our arrival. He is anxious to get together." Chapter 67 Aix-les-Bains, France, 1912. Morgan was at the ornate Louis XVI style desk in his plush hotel room. He looked anxiously at his solid gold pocket watch, a graduation gift from his father. He was uneasy, thinking and thinking. He had just finished a fine dinner with Bella and was enjoying more sherry. He looked at the paper that read, "Titanic near miss. After the champagne hit the bowl, the SS New York almost hit the stern. Titanic's propeller is the culprit." Morgan threw down the paper. He had come to France to get away from it, but couldn't. His blood pressure went up. His face flushed. He poured another sherry from the crystal decanter. This was his one hideaway to relax. This wasn't a good start. X was generally the place to be for the rich at that time of the year. X was a historical bath during the Roman Empire. Massages and pampering was always in vogue. The private soaking areas of this spa retreat were now for the well-to-do like Morgan. Aix-les-Bains was situated in the hilly country of the Bugey that forms the foothills of the Alps. It was a beautiful area and drew the noted people for business or pleasure. The famous waters of the spa had always soothed Morgan. The hot springs were a perfect temperature for long soaks of hydrotherapy that would relieve tension, arthritis, and other ailments that Morgan had. The healing water, the sulfur, made his bones feel renewed. It usually cured what ailed him. Mostly tension. He was wound up tight as a spring, and he found as he frequented here with Bella, the results in rejuvenating his spirit were marvelous. Morgan was not one to drink water, but the sweet water of the cold spring was delightful, and even Morgan enjoyed a cool drink after the long hot soaks. Morgan could sit in the spring for hours. He read, relaxed, talked and had his mistress. But this trip he wanted solitude. This trip his mind was preoccupied by lingering thoughts. Even his sleep was disturbed. He hadn't slept in weeks, since the whole Olympic issue had come to the forefront. Why had this whole thing happened? Why did Olympic fail? Why did her design have to be flawed? Was this plan he was undertaking going to work? Should he send a wireless to Smith and stop the whole thing? It would be easy, one little message that could stop it all. How bitter his mind felt. He hated thinking about it. He hated that he couldn't stop his thoughts from forming like big dark clouds hovering in his head. He could drive himself crazy thinking. He had come to the spa to soak those thoughts away. If this place couldn't relieve him, nowhere would. There were many details, many things he did not want to have to face, but such is the way business had always been for him. So why was this any different? For all intents and purposes, he should have been celebrating. Soon he would have the insurance and he would be able to move forward on his other ventures, securing his empire and setting up Jack with the keys to the kingdom. He wanted it to feel good, but he had no one to celebrate with. He had to keep the secret to himself. He was no one to be around at the moment, in this dark and foreboding mood. He didn't want to even be around himself. The small pool was steaming hot. He removed his clothes and looked at that guilty reflection that stared back at him over the surface of the water. Chapter 68. RMS Titanic, North Atlantic Ocean, 1912. The first 3 days of the voyage from Queenstown passed without incident. The ship was days out now and had gone without a mishap since Southampton. Temperatures remained fairly mild on Saturday, April 13th, then Sunday Titanic crossed a cold weather front, with waves of up to 8 feet and strong winds. These died down as the day progressed until, by the evening of April 14th, it became clear, calm and cold. In the officers' quarters, there was a drinks party in full swing. The officers, with other senior members of the crew, many of whom were on duty, were drinking. Captain Smith had just returned earlier from the party thrown in his honor by the Widener family, American first-class passengers and acquaintances of the good captain. With all on his mind, he needed a few stiff ones to get through. This was the night. The hour was drawing near. Would the officers be entertained enough? Would they believe we had hit a berg just because the crow's nest yelled so? Seaman Louise Klein happened to walk past, heard the noise and investigated. He was shocked to see the on-duty crew, including officers, liberally downing alcoholic beverages, totally against strict maritime rules and regulations, for obvious reasons. In the wireless cabin at this time, Phillips and Bride, the two Marconi operators, were inundated with requests from first-class passengers to send Marconi grams to their waiting relatives, informing them of their expected arrival time in New York later that week. "Oh God, here's more. This is never bloody ending," lamented Bride. "We'll never get to bed tonight," he added. In the first-class smoking room, while enjoying their after-dinner brandies and cigars, Astor showed Strauss the wireless gram message that his personal servant had just brought him directly from the wireless cabin. "Lindbergh will meet us in New York about the banking bill," he said, then leaned closer. "Have you noticed a vibration?" "At the staircase, I do notice it, quite so," answered Strauss. "Yes, it was rather apparent," said Astor. "I want to have a word with the captain on the matter. I'll just check on Madeline and then see to it." "Yes, I should like to go with you later as well," said Strauss. Strauss and Astor had finished their cigars and emptied their glasses. They bade each other goodnight and headed back to their staterooms. Astor was just about to turn the handle to check on Madeline first. She being pregnant, he was concerned and very much in love. But as he opened the door, he found the stateroom empty. Madeline was gone. Astor went down the corridor. He was about to head upstairs when he spotted Madeline. She was entering from the deck, coming toward him. There was an unsettling look on her face. "Come with me," she said. "What are you doing out so late? Is everything all right? Where have you been?" he worried. "I was on our promenade deck." "Just hurry," she said. "I have some business with the captain." "It will have to wait," he said. "No. It's important." "What can be so important at this hour? Surely it will wait till morning," he said. "You will have to see it." "I'm frightened," and she showed it in her eyes. It's freezing out there and you are in such a delicate condition," he said. "John, I want to show you something," Madeline was reluctant to explain. "Why are we going out this late? Are you warm enough? Are you coming?" she demanded. "I thought you were going to wait for me in the suite," he hesitated, put his coat on her, and they made their way to the promenade deck. "You won't believe it. There is something on this ship," her voice shivered. They came through their cabins and staterooms. She drew him to a secluded dark spot. Chapter 69. Aix-les-Bains, France, 1912. In his Aix-les-Bains spa, Morgan was drained. He couldn't talk to Bella now. He needed to be alone. He didn't want her to read his face, for she would surely see darkness. It was horrible to feel this inability to concentrate. A depression of great magnitude loomed over him. As he stood looking into the water, he couldn't get his feet to move to the step. Water dripped into the spa. It drummed out a writ to remind him with every beat that he was about to be the instigator of a terrible event. All the planning now had come to this moment. Morgan knew the scheme inside and out. That was the problem. He couldn't get it out of his mind. What was it about the whole thing that didn't sit well? He didn't want to know. He stared for a long while at his reflection in the pool as he stood over it, the steam creeping above it. He glanced at his pocket watch and realized that the dry was now cast and that there was now no turning back. He could no more stop the chain of events that he had already unleashed than he could run away a locomotive with his bare hands, even if he had wanted to. There was no way. He wanted to get in the water if only he could move, but he was like a deer on the train tracks, just frozen, Chapter 70. RMS Titanic, North Atlantic Ocean, 1912. In the frigid dark of the night, Titanic was making her way. She strode sleek and elegant in the waters of the cold Atlantic. Smoke was pouring out her funnels as the black ray puffs briefly held in the air and then disappeared into the chilly night. Down in third class, the vibration was noticeable, masked only by the pounding of the boilers. "Are you feeling the vibration?" said the greaser.
"Yeah, who couldn't?" said Archie.
"Yeah, but what the hell is causing that?"
"I've been feeling it since we left port," said the greaser.
"No one wants to answer that. I'm told to just do my job." Archie's displeased look said it all. Up on the promenade deck, Madeline was almost in tears. She grabbed John's arm and pulled him along their private promenade deck. John was stunned that Madeline was so worried.
"What is it?" he asked her.
"I really need to speak to the captain on an urgent matter.
Won't this wait?"
"We were on Olympic," she replied, concerned.
"This is the Titanic.
We came over on the Olympic. They're twins after all," he tried to reassure her.
"I'm going to show you something that will make you change your mind.
Look," she said, fearing, as she pointed at a wooden deck rail post. On the post was a small inconspicuous love heart carved into the wood. It had the initials J and N within it. He could not believe his own eyes. He became alarmed and could feel a foreboding of danger and a panic rising in his chest. He led Madeline back to the warmth of the stateroom.
"Wait here, I'll be right back," he promised her.
"But John," she began.
"Where are you going?"
"I want Strauss to see this," he said reassuringly. The bell on the Strauss's stateroom door rang, just as Mrs. Strauss had turned down the lights to retire for the night.
"Who can that be at this time of night?
What do they want, I wonder?" Mrs. Strauss asked.
"It's Esther.
He and I were going to have a word with the captain." He walked towards the outer door.
"Strauss, it's me," came the unmistakable sound of Esther's voice through the door.
"Please open up."
Strauss unlocked the door. It burst open.
"Get your coat.
Come with me.
Please.
It's important. Please do hurry," Esther urged him.
Strauss grabbed his coat.
"What is it?" he queried.
Several minutes later, they were standing on the Astor's promenade deck, staring through the freezing cold night air at a railing post. Esther gestured for Strauss to look carefully at it.
"What am I supposed to be looking at, John?"
"What is this?" asked Strauss.
"So, you made a heart for Madeline," he joked with Esther, not comprehending his meaning at all, or the inherent implications.
But Esther wasn't laughing. A sudden feeling of concern swept over Strauss.
"No, I never carved anything on this ship," Esther said.
"So what is this?" Strauss asked.
"This is impossible.
This is the exact heart I carved for Madeline when we came across on Olympic." Astor's heart was almost beating out of his chest.
"But this is Titanic," said Esther.
"Oh my good God," was all that Strauss could manage by way of a reply. He was struck with a dark thought.
"Something wicked this way comes." The breath of Astor's words hung in the air too long, steamy and hot, till the freeze finally took them, like a wisp of an angel, into the vast expanse. They made their way back into the staterooms. They were going to make a plan. John wanted Madeline safe and warm within the confines of the drawing room. But just then, in the Astor suite, there was a vague rumbling sound, an almost indiscernible jolt, closely followed by an almost eerie silence. The ship's engines had stopped. Chapter 71 American Inquiry on Titanic Disaster, New York, 1912. Senator William Walden Smith, the presiding officer, was questioning Captain Stanley Lord, of the Californian. "Please tell us in your own words, Captain Lord, what you saw whilst you were waiting, stopped in the ice field," the senator asked him. "I saw another steamer approaching and asked the wireless operator what vessels he had within reach," he replied, "the Titanic," whereupon I replied, "That is not the Titanic, she is too small and hasn't enough lights." Shortly afterwards a steamer stopped and was bearing SSE about 5 or 6 miles from our position. Then the chief officer reported that he saw a foremast steamer with a yellow funnel rapidly steaming away from the area, Lord responded. Chapter 72 Nemo, 1993 Deep down, a league under the sea, Nemo moved silently and as easily as the creatures born here. Her eerie lights were the only signs that she was a metal intruder, not like those of scales and blood. In the deep waters here in the cold Atlantic, it was coming to a point where deception was no longer useful. The answers were more intriguing than the questions. Masters was running out of fight. And now he questioned himself, what was it all for? He knew that better than anyone. He was feeling crushed. The lies did nothing but fester, his soul being reined in by the truth of it all. His whole facade was torn by the delving of this woman. She was only a creature, no different than the unique sea creatures down here, below. Why did it matter what she thought? Why couldn't he carry on as before? This was a creature he knew not how to deal with, who was making him face it all. All the years of lies came down to haunt him in this moment. He wanted to tell it all. Have it fall on the tender ears of this flesh and blood woman. Like that could make a difference. Like the words could come out of his mouth and be cleansed, like he himself would be rid of it all. If only his head could lie on her lap and gently be saved from the torment that overwhelmed him. He moved his lips, and some resemblance of his heart took the lead. The words came out defensive and wrong. "I've spent a life's work on Titanic. It's hard to let go, but I heard stories, stories of people's lives. There's the story of the rocket box, sitting on seafloor, the colored rockets still there. No one asks about that story, but it all comes down to a few guys with money that are going to cut her hell for the gold." Jade sensed something different in Master's tone. It was as if they were sitting in a bar and he'd had a few too many drinks, opening up to her, laying it all on the line. She had thought he was bent on stopping her, but he was after something else, something he felt loyal to, something that he wanted to make meaning of, but that was now falling apart like a house of cards in a windstorm. Jade had a feeling she could trust in, it was all falling into place. Maybe a few answers could satisfy all her questions? What if they found out it was Olympic and there was no gold and they wouldn't have to tear her apart? There would be no gold, no reason to cut into her. Her words came easy. "Why don't you tell them?" "You gotta prove it," he said. Masters realized that maybe helping Jade would be smart for that very reason. He was open to that at this point, glad she hadn't just tossed everything back at him in a fight. "So you got to ask yourself, is it Olympic you want to save, or Titanic?" Jade proposed. Things looked different to League Under the Sea. This trip was different. "Shit, Olympic?" is all Johns could say. Up top on the Atlantic Siren, Billy readied the cargo hold. Dudley radioed to Flynn. "We're sending down the cargo lift for the first load." "Copy." The cargo tower was let down and quickly descended, since it had no pressure issues. Johns, with the radio off, was unaware of the position. Flynn, maneuver to 137. Why the hell is Masters offline? Keep trying him. Copy. The soft lights in the tiny sub glowed as the pressure and all the little craft's other vital functions looked good. Johns continued moving toward the nameplate. Even he was caught up in the moment. Masters adjusted Nemo's exterior camera and aimed it toward the rusticles on Titanic's bow. He got magnificent shots as they moved closer to the bow. Masters pulled out the Nemo's arms to take off the rusticles. Jade adjusted her video camera. It's only a matter of time with technology before someone will find out there was a switch, he said. That's the real reason for the law to declare her untouchable. So the switch is kept secret. Up top, Atlantic Siren, Dudley and Greg had broken down the door and were ransacking Jade's cabin. They took her camera bag and ripped out the tapes from the tape deck. They found her notebooks, scripts and several other cases containing a number of logged tapes and all the tapes she had shot, the very shots and story that would make her documentary powerful and convincing. They went to Mac's cabin. They grabbed all his equipment and searched his cabin for anything that looked daunting or could expose this dubious venture. They went out to the deck and dumped the stuff over the side of the ship and stood there for a moment watching it all sink into the blue blackness. Soon the tapes would be as silent as Titanic in the cold and listless depths of the sea, keeping the secrets that they shared with the grand old lady. Below, in the deep waters, Nemo was at Titanic's rusting hull. Chapter 73. RMS Titanic, North Atlantic Ocean, 1912. Outside, in the cold blackness of the night, an unidentified steamer with a single yellow funnel was moving at high speed towards Titanic. All its lights were off, as she deftly moved, unnoticed. On Titanic's second deck that late, cold night, was a young Italian, Raimondo Vittel. He was smoking a cigarette, used to being up at this hour while most others were inside. Vittel had such grand thoughts about going to America, as he stood on the empty deck. He wanted to impress his family and make something of his life, perhaps invest in a business. The prospects in the new country seemed vast. As he dreamed, he looked out on the ocean so calm and clear. He spotted something that caught his eye. A ship. He saw it coming. It was hard to see, but he had good eyes and could tell it was a ship. It drew closer. He watched it for several minutes, all the while coming closer. Was she coming to meet Titanic? Why were her lights off? Why was she coming so close? Her line was straight to the bow. Vito thought it strange and watched her. The silent ship came now, sure to hit, as she headed dark and quick. He tossed his cigarette over the rail. Is there anyone else seeing this? He thought. Holy Mamma Mia of the God, he said under his breath. He wondered why the crow's nest was not ringing the bell or flashing the moors or sounding the foghorn. Do something, he thought. She's getting too close. She's coming straight along. He looked for someone to yell to, but the deck was empty. He ran to the staircase to head to the bridge, but it was all locked and it was deserted looking. He ran back to the rail and just then the ship hit the starboard side bow, below the waterline. He looked up the front and way up there he saw a couple of passengers leaning over the rail watching her take off. He leaned up over the rail, but there was a black darkness with only glimpses of the moon glistening on the ripple. He could see nothing, so tall and high was Titanic. Ice fell from the rigging and hit the deck. Was there damage? He thought. There had to be. It was dark indeed. Fright came over Vittel.
What is going on?
Is the crow's nest taking action?
Didn't even see it?
He could see the man up in it as he leaned out, but he was too far to yell, he thought. Titanic was so large, he was too far from the passengers that he had seen up ahead on the other deck.
Vittel was stunned.
He ran to another part of the rail. He saw a few small icebergs off the way, but he knew what he saw, the yellow funneled steamer. He could smell her stacks steaming on full, coming in low, as the gust of her hit and sent the funnel fumes toward him. He knew she had hit Titanic. He had felt the jolt. But what did he just see? He just couldn't believe it with the size of her in the dark night that the steamer could hit her with all Titanic's lights on. It was impossible. And it looked like he'd never find the other two, up on the other deck, who had seemed to see it too. Unknown to most of those on board, least of all the passengers, she had performed her deadly hit and run attack. Then the whistle came from the crow's nest, but it was too far. There was now a hole in the starboard bow of Titanic. The gash that had penetrated at least 6 feet into Titanic's delicate innards. Through this gash, hundreds of gallons of seawater would slowly fill into her hull, slowly but surely filling the bulkheads, one by one. They didn't know they only had 2.5 hours left till she was on the other side of the water. Chapter 74. SS Californian, North Atlantic Ocean, 1912. On board the Californian, approximately 19 miles from Titanic, Captain Stanley Lord was waiting patiently out on the open bridge wing, scanning the horizon all around for any sign of the promise-colored rockets. The stars were there, countless in the sky as they surged. Then, suddenly, he spotted the rocket, then another and another, but was hard-pressed, as they were only white, with not a single red or blue one to be seen. He remembered Morgan's words. They were imprinted indelibly on his brain. Titanic will send up colored rockets only. Look for the colored rockets only. Ignore the white ones, Morgan had clearly said. Nevertheless, it was puzzling. Who would be sending up white rockets and right now of all times? He wondered. It was probably company signals from one line's ship to another, he reasoned with himself. Not all ships had yet installed this newfangled wireless, especially the smaller ones and the smaller shipping lines. Yes, that would be it. Have you seen any colored rockets yet? He asked the lookout, on more than one occasion. No, sir, only white, he replied. The star-filled sky stretched far, while only miles away on Titanic they were now in distress. Where, Lord and Californian? Where in God's name are they? Captain Smith was now almost frantic, as was Ismay. They were in the wireless room where Phillips and Brian were desperately trying to contact anyone who would listen. Only the Carpathia was anywhere near enough, and even she was too far away to be of any help right now. Smith looked at his watch again. The time was speeding by, and Titanic was now definitely noticeably down by the head, already. They could now see the angle of the deck sloping away towards the bow through the open wireless cabin door. What the hell? Ismay said. We must have sent 20 or more rockets by now. Where the hell is Lord? What is he doing? Are you sure the rockets were white? He asked. So now we see why Morgan's not here, said Smith. Christ, Ismay could hardly say. Shit. Scotland Road is flooded and holding her level, Smith said. Can we shut her down? No, we'll capsize. It's too late to stop it. We only have an hour. You better get these passengers in the boats. Is there nothing we can do? Asked Captain Smith. The frantic words hit Andrew's ears.
Nothing.
It's stuck in the captain's head. It's too late, there's nothing we can do.
Chapter 75. RMS Titanic, North Atlantic Ocean, 1912.
The room was dark as a knock came to the door. Benjamin Guggenheim was rousted from bed, annoyed to be disturbed at this hour. He knocked on the adjoining stateroom door and, in turn, rousted his Italian valet, Victor Giglio, to see who it was.